The following program is dedicated to all of those who served down on the ice of Antarctica and the Seabees who built the bases.
Live from the Veterans Radio Studios and the Ave Maria Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host for today's program, former CB, Gary Lilly.
And good morning out there around the world. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We've got a great program lined up today. It's going to be funny. It's going to be interesting. I've already learned so many things I didn't know about Operation Deep Freeze down on the ice shelf of Antarctica. Ooh, those guys.
And Antarctica, is that a continent, all
yes.
Ice? Does it actually have ground under it?
It's got volcanoes under it. Yes, not under it, sticking up. Active volcanoes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, there was dirt down there.
Ooh, I want to know all about Antarctica. I know nothing.
Bob Gould. Here is Bob Gould.
Yes, here
Big
we are.
101st Airborne.
101, and to all my brothers and sisters out there, my military brothers and sisters, welcome to Veterans Radio.
And over there in the control booth, we've got Matt running things, keeping him running smoothly. Matt Dewar, good morning.
Good morning.
And sitting right next to you is Kai. Good morning, Kai.
Good morning, everybody. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you here, Kai. Fun listening to you this morning, practicing your announcements on the air.
Oh, he's doing great.
He is. I like the heck out of him. Hit him on the shoulder, push him out of the way. And you know why I'm not afraid of pushing you out of the way, Kai? You wouldn't hit an old man, would you? So, we have a lot
he's
of fun.
He's not answering.
No. We have a lot of fun with those guys. They're really good guys. Matt and Kai, what a blessing. Bob. We've got this program lined up. We're going to have Bill George and Dale Cockrell. They were two CBs wintered over on the ice down in, I think it was 67. I'll find out for sure. And right now, though, you've gone through something that I just, we want to get the message out.
Oy.
And it has to do with your health.
Oy. Okay. I'll make this very quick. I have a debilitating serious illness that has to do with a lot of pain, etc. And I was in the VA system. Now, the VA system is wonderful, wonderful health care, but it's protocol, yes, by the numbers. And for the last 6 months, they weren't misdiagnosing. They were missing the treatment modality because I still had tremendous pain, etc. The point I'm making is that I went out and did the research myself, and it was one sentence that I found in the research, looking on the Internet.
You bought a book.
I bought a book from the Trigeminal Neuralgia Association, studied it, and I found that sentence, and I am now on the road to recovery because I did something about it through my own dentist, and it's made a significant difference. The point I want to make is that I went out and did the research. So, folks, when you're dealing with the VA, don't be afraid to ask questions.
When you're dealing with any
Anybody,
situation, because we have a member of our Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, Don, about 4 years ago, was given 18 months to live, and he was sick-looking. And he didn't accept that. He said, I'm going to find out if there's anything I can do. He researched it, found different things he could do to change his lifestyle, got rid of all the fillings in his teeth, the mercury fillings, made other changes in his life. It's been 4 years. He's healthier looking than I've ever seen him. Don't just listen to the doctors. I'm not saying anything bad about the doctors. Do your own research and get involved.
And ask questions.
Absolutely.
I actually had the guy sit down. Oh, yeah. He's a big-time board-certified neurologist, and he's standing up, looking down at me. Whoa. Have a seat, eyeball to eyeball. Yeah, this man's not military, obviously. Eyeball to eyeball.
Yeah, good for you. And speaking of eyeballs, I see life in your eyes that hasn't been there for a long time. Okay, we got something really good coming up.
Woo! Yeah, the Vietnam War 50th Anniversary Welcome Home Rally. That's what they call it now, the Welcome Home Rally.
And this is the 50th anniversary, 50th. The beginning of it.
Yeah, who made that decision?
Congress. You know, before that, you don't get compensation. After that, you get compensation.
I just fell into the wire. I am a Vietnam veteran, but Vietnam-era veteran. But anyway, the 50th anniversary is coming up on Saturday, May the 21st. We've been invited, as you well know, and you've been doing the work, to have our live broadcast from this Welcome Home rally. That will be in Hudson, Ohio. Exit 180, off the turnpike, that's right. Sergeant Hack, Sergeant Dave Hack, Vietnam veteran, received the Purple Heart and other decorations. Folks, you need to go to uswings.com and check this out about the rally and check out the Sarge's business.
Who has he got?
What a business.
I drool when I go over there. He makes all of those leather flying coats.
Oh, they're so cool.
A lot of military clothing, and they are so good. Well, he supplies the U.S.
military. He supplies the military. These are not replicas. The real deal.
And not just ours. Australia, New Zealand, Hollywood, and this is how good they are. Well, Jim Belushi bought 500 leather coats to give as gifts.
He didn't send one to me, though.
Jim and Eric Clapton bought 400. And if you've ever seen those John Travolta commercials, where he's standing in front of a plane with his leather coat on, that's a U.S. Wings.
USWings.com.
Right. And Sarge Hack is the coolest guy going.
Well, I'll make this very quick because all military, whether you're a Vietnam veteran or not, are invited, and some of you civilians, too. There will be a 3-day rally, so not only the 21st, but we got the bookends, the 20th and the 22nd of May in Hudson, Ohio, right off the turnpike. It's right there, quarter of a mile off of exit 180, the Ohio turnpike. I'm trying to remember, what is that, 80? Okay. Is that what that is?
Yes.
Turnpike 80?
Yes.
Right.
80.
Yeah. Okay, something like that. You know, everything changes in Ohio.
I want to mention a couple of things because you said for people that are not Vietnam veterans, that's true. They want to make this an educational event. They want people to learn about the real Vietnam history. And they're going to have some really neat things. They're going to have the Golden Knights. Golden Knights.
That's right.
They're going to have some military units camping out, helicopter flyovers, and vendors. And vendors, you get free space. They're providing free food, hot dogs, and soft drinks.
And there will be food available. There will be camping space available. There'll be food for sale, and there'll be some food that will be available for the non-campers, etc. You want to go to uswings.com. Check this out. Oh, by the way, where are you going to get a Top Gun leather jacket?
The real deal. Yeah, they've got a retail store there.
No, it's not a replica. Real deal. They're beautiful. Check those out. Anyway, uswings.com. Yes, you have something there.
One last thing.
Oh, yeah.
For the Catholics and non-Catholics, it will end up Sunday morning at 10 a.m. with a mass set over the hood of a Jeep.
Oh, just like it was in Nam.
Just like it was.
And they're going to be using a lowboy for the stage on their entertainment, which will be throughout the 3 days. A lowboy, just like it was down there in Da Nang or wherever the devil that they pull those things in.
All right, good deal. Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
And there's going to be a lot of troops coming home, and coming home to the 50th anniversary rally, and from Veterans Radio to all of you troops coming home, welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. And for those of you who are looking for the webcast, due to technical difficulties, we don't have it today. Had all sorts of great photographs and Navy artists that documented the building of Little America. What a shame I can't show them to you folks, but boy, did I have fun looking them up. Little America, Operation Deep Freeze. And our guest today will be talking about wintering over on Operation Deep Freeze. We have Bill George on the line and Dale Cockrell, two Seabees. And I just want to say to you first, Bill, good morning and welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. And Dale Cockrell, good morning to you, too.
Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I've known Bill for a number of years and heard his stories about being over on the ice. I haven't met you, Dale, but I'm interested in hearing your stories. A lot of them are dramatic, and a lot of them are the hard work that Seabees do. Now, I know that from my own experience, but also a lot of them are very, very funny. First off, Bill, tell us, what is Operation Deep Freeze?
Operation Deep Freeze was an agreement. I believe they started with an international agreement in 1957, where the a certain amount of communities, national communities, agreed to have saved the continent of Antarctica for scientific research. And the reason that we were there for the United States was basically the Seabees were there to support the civilian scientists in their scientific research. And so we took care of the issues of providing them with transportation, roads, anything they would need in the way of food, shelter, water, that type of thing. Big operation. The main base that Dale and I were located at was McMurdo. And McMurdo was the main supply base for the continent. And so in the summer months, which ran from October till about the 1st of March, our population there was probably somewhere between 1,200 and 1,300 people.
I had no idea. Go ahead.
But after the last plane left in March, then our population dropped to about 180. So that sort of gives you an idea of where we were at and the size of our operation.
Dale, what was the difference in the populations, the summer population of 1,200 to the winter population of 180?
The summer population, you never really got to know anyone other than the people you worked directly with. In the winter, you got to know everybody, and through that experience, some long-lasting friendships have been developed, or were developed at that time.
And as a matter of fact, you guys are on a reunion right now of Operation Deep Freeze people, or was it just for your year?
It's just for the winter over 69-70 group. You know, we wouldn't turn anybody away, you know, if they wanted to come and join us, but it's primarily for the winter over group that we were with.
As a matter of fact, I understand there was you guys ran into somebody on the street who was just a real fan of Operation Deep Freeze, and when he met you guys, you invited him over to sit and socialize.
Well, right? Yeah.
Did he show up?
As a matter of fact, last night I was not here, but he did. I heard from some of my other friends that were here. He got himself into our hotel, and he come up, and I guess he introduced himself to a couple of people, and he was just infatuated with Antarctica. So, eager guy, wanted to talk to people who had been there, and he had not been there. He was just a guy that liked to read about it. It was funny. He would be a primary guy who would volunteer to go there. He was just interested in the place.
He seemed to
know all about it.
We've got we've all met those kinds of people, and they're really fun to be around. The difference in 1,000 population, though, were those all scientists, the people that went home?
No, not necessarily. Some of them were what we call summer support. They were attached to the Antarctic Support Activity Summer Support Group, and they would come down for the summer season only, and they would make multiple trips south. Whereas the people who wintered over, we were in Detachment Alpha, which was designated for winter over, and we were there for the year. And after the year was up, we would either get orders for another duty station or get out, whichever the case might have been.
What's the purpose? Now, this is military run or military base, but it's for it's not for military use. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, Dale. Right. The what do they study down there? What are they trying to learn? Do you have any idea, Dale?
Well, yeah. You know, the year that we were there, the big news was they had a place they were researching called Dry Valleys. And I think Dry Valleys was maybe about 50 miles away from McMurdo. And they ran the helicopters out there quite a bit. And these scientists would go out there. The unique thing about it was a section of Antarctica that had very little snow or ice. The climate in Antarctica is often described as a desert climate because there's so little actual precipitation that falls out of the sky. In fact, they've made comments that they get less precipitation a year than some of the major deserts in the world. But the snow that's there, when the wind kicks up sometimes in excess of 100 miles an hour, then it picks up the snow off the plane and blows it. So this Dry Valleys was a place where they could actually get right down to soil and rock. And I think that the year that we were there in 69 and 70, and the year we were there, they found fossils of tropical plants. And so they knew that they had determined that, at one time the area of Antarctica probably was tropical, and either because of continental drift or if the Earth had shifted poles, something had happened that changed, obviously. Change the climate.
Bill, when you got orders for Antarctica, was this something you volunteered for, or the military said, hey, guess where you're going?
We both have different stories there.
You know, I'll tell you, with me, my company commander, we were getting out of boot camp, and we were what you would call, we were volunteers. But when there were 32 of us out of Gulfport, and they told us that they said, we're going to have a little guessing game here. We're going to let you guess where you're going. And they said, all we're going to hint to you is you're going south. And this was during the Vietnam thing, and we're all perking up because we thought we were going somewhere down close to the equator, you know. And so each time we would guess a base that was south, he'd say further south. And finally somebody asked, was it Australia? And he said, no. And at the time, with me being a young, a kid, I didn't think there was anything south of Australia. I thought Australia was about the bottom of the world, you know. Found out that wasn't the case, you know.
It's a long way south of Australia, isn't it?
Yeah.
It gets colder and colder. Now, how did they ship you there, by ship or by airplane?
You know, we went by airplane. The ASA is called Antarctic Support Activity. They flew, I believe it was six C-130 Hercules, and they had two troop transport planes that were the old TWA Constellations. I think the number was the C-121.
Uh-huh.
And so from Davisville, Rhode Island, to the ice, I flew one of the Constellations, and it was 52 hours flying time.
Yeah.
sometimes we'd look out the window and we'd swear the geese were flying faster than us, you know.
I came up with a now was that the Super Constellation, the double decker plane?
No, wasn't a double decker, but they referred to it as the Constellation.
Okay.
And had the triple tails on the end of it. Everybody knew what they were.
Yes. Yep.
They were a very reliable plane,
right,
you know? But as technology moved on, they got slower and slower. You know?
I've interviewed guys that were the listening post, you know, that they would fly off of China and fly off of the Soviet Union and such and listen in on their transmissions in those super constellations. And they would. I was stunned when I heard that they were 32-hour flights and all that, but you're saying it was a 52-hour flight?
Well, it was actually what it was 52 hours flying time. We would hop.
Okay.
We hopped, we hopped across the United States, then we hopped to Hawaii, then from Hawaii, we went to New Zealand, which was about a 24-hour run, but they would stop in the American Samoas to refuel.
Okay,
but total, total flying time was 52 hours.
Oh, heck, I got you beat. That took us 3 days to get to Vietnam on this old 4-inch and C-118 that leaks more oil than a well could produce in a day. You learn how big the ocean is when you're in a plane like that, don't you?
That's the truth. You know, there's nothing to do. Everybody had books. They were, you know, they were reading books because you just sit there and, you know, the engines were just thrown on and there was nothing to see.
Did you? Who was I talking to just now? Bill or Dale?
That was Bill.
That was okay. you guys sound a lot alike. Bill, when you looked down at the ocean, did you start seeing ice down there? At some
well,
point.
When I was flying from New Zealand to into McMurdo, I was in a Hercules and there was no window, so I presume that if you were looking out a window, you would eventually saw ice.
So you didn't see anything until
I think I slept most of the way. I'm not sure.
Well, they've got airstrips down there on Antarctica. Did you guys, either of you, work on the airstrip?
That was one of my primary jobs, was
Bill.
The sea ice was to go out and measure the density of it and the thickness of it so we could determine if it was still safe.
What's the biggest plane that they can bring in on that airstrip on the ice?
C-5s have been in there.
How big are they? Big.
It's the largest airplane in our inventory, ours being the U.S. I am not sure the tonnage of it, but they are mammoth.
You could stand up in the engines, right?
Oh, yeah. They're big enough that they can take a M1 Abrams tank and still have room left over.
And this airstrip is pure ice, right?
Pure ice. Well, yes and no. If you get out on the Ross Ice Shelf, it's covered with snow, but there's one on the sea ice, which...
What? Gary, let me elaborate a little bit on that. I worked out at the airstrip during the summer when it was operational, and we had a blue ice runway, which was on annual ice, and we had a skiway, which was on glacial ice. And the Hercs used the skiway, and the wheeled airplanes used the annual ice. And we had to stop using the blue ice runway, I think around the 1st of December, was it?
Yeah, 1st of December.
Right around, because the ice would get down too thin. And Dale might know this. There was a certain thickness specification. When it got under that thickness, they stopped landing the planes on the blue ice runway. And then we would only use the skiways, which was for the HERC. So if you can picture this, McMurdo sat on a volcanic island, which was volcanic rock. But where it sat, there was a glacier met with the sea. So you had three entities there. You had annual ice that went out most years. You had the glacial ice that slowly moved toward the annual ice. And then you had land, which was where McMurdo was built. And this whole thing... The airstrip, which was Williams Field, was approximately 5 miles out on the glacier away from McMurdo, if you can picture that. And the roads that we had sort of formed a large circle. You'd come out of McMurdo, you'd come out to Williams Field, and there'd be the skiway, and then you'd come to the blue ice, the annual ice runway, and the road would take you back to McMurdo. So if you can picture that type
okay.
of situation.
And was the planes that came in, they weren't strictly on skis. They were wheeled aircraft, were they? Wheels?
Some of them were wheeled. C-130s were ski-equipped. The Super Connies, they were wheel-equipped. They had 141s that came in, brought supplies in. They were wheeled. And
all of them landed on ice?
All of them landed on ice.
Well, that had to be smoother than a hockey rink.
It could get rough.
Oh, okay. So they sent good. They sent good pilots.
Toward the end of the summer season, the sea ice started developing ridges in it. The density of it started deteriorating, and it got to where it was not the
Dale,
place to land.
Bill mentioned that. When it got to it started losing its thickness, they stopped using it. How thick would that be, Dale?
The thickest I ever measured was about 13 feet, and toward the end of the use, it was down to about 5 feet. So, and it had a lot of air pockets in it, so it was deteriorating both in thickness and in density.
Bill, that brings up a point. In the early days, there were some accidents. How were those airstrips named, Bill?
Well, Williams Field was named after an equipment operator by the name of Carl Williams, and Carl Williams lost his life. He was they were offloading a ship. The ship had come in, and they were offloading on the ice. And Carl Williams ran a dozer, a Caterpillar dozer, with usually they had 20-ton sleds, or capacity they could handle 20 tons. And Carl Williams, unfortunately, they had a fault in the ice at one place, and they had done some work on it with putting wood bridges in to sort of spread out the weight. But in his particular case, he had crossed this bridge, and his dozer had gone across it okay, but the sled he was pulling, when he hit the snow bridge, broke through and then pulled him in backwards. And the situation, I don't know if it's changed any now, but then it's hard to imagine with water that cold. It was pretty much, if he went into the water, there was no saving. You know, no. People have asked, you know, couldn't they have gotten this guy or whatever? But paralysis, the water was so cold that paralysis would set in almost instantly. So if you hit that seawater, you know, for any reason, whatever, you went in, and in his case, being inside that dozer, you know, it happened so quick, and those things were, you know, so heavy that he was gone. As soon as they went in, that was it. He was gone.
This is remarkable. So this is remarkable because when I was a kid, they would show news clips before movies, and
yeah.
I remember seeing a news clip about building Little America, which was what the early camps were named. And they showed that news clip of him busting through the ice and going. I remember that as a kid. Yep. That's they wouldn't show that today, but that was. I'll always remember seeing that. Now,
our motto when we were there on Sundays was a day off for us, and a lot of times the New Zealanders would come by our base with their dog sleds, and they'd be on their way. Going out to visit something out on a glacial or something, and they'd invite us to go along with them. And our motto always was down there, we really don't want an airstrip named after us. So we would decline their offers. These guys, they would go anywhere out there without a second thought. And most of the American guys, you know, they were pretty conservative about going anywhere.
New Zealanders are crazy. I mean, they're crazy.
Yeah.
We've all heard the stories about New Zealanders. They're crazy in combat, and they're crazy in things like that. They're wild men.
I'll tell you, the crew that we had down there, they were, like I say, they were hardy guys, and they wouldn't give a thought about taking off out on a glacier with dog sleds. They'd be gone, and, you know, they'd come through our camp and stop and talk and that. But, you know, like I say, we declined. We stuck close to home.
When I said they're crazy, I say that lovingly. I say it admiringly. These guys are something else, like early mountain men here. Now, they had dog sleds. Bill, how do they feed those dogs?
Well, you know, it's a funny situation down there. We had, in the international agreement, the continent of Antarctica is weapons-free, and they would have annual inspections. They'd have a committee come to the ice and visit all these stations to make sure that nobody had weapons at these stations. However, the New Zealanders were allotted 130-06 there, and they would shoot seals at the pressure ridges for dog food. They'd use the seal. They'd feed the seal meat to their dog. So they always told us that, you know, when most of the Americans, if we went anywhere on the ice, we always had snowmobiles. And the New Zealanders always used the sled dog.
Okay.
And they would say to us, you know, if you ever get out there on the ice and you get pinned down, these dogs, they can provide heat for us. And there's a lot of things a dog can provide.
All right, we're on a break right now. We'll be back right after this announcement.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Ensign Robert Carey held a watertight door open to let crewmen escape, despite escaping steam from a ruptured boiler. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Carrie, on board the USS San Diego on January 21st, 1915, began to take half-hourly readings of the steam pressure at every boiler. He had read the steam and air pressure on number 2 boiler and was just stepping through the electric watertight door into number 1 fire room when the boilers in number 2 fire room exploded. Carrie stopped and held open the doors, which were being closed electrically from the bridge, and yelled to the men in number 2 fire room to escape. 3 of them did. Carrie's action undoubtedly saved the lives of these men. He held the doors probably a minute with the escaping steam from the ruptured boilers around him. His example of coolness did much to keep the men in number 1 fire room at their post, hauling fires, although 5 boilers in their immediate vicinity had exploded, and boilers number 1 and 3 apparently had no water in them and were likely to explode any instant. Carrie directed the men in this fire room into the bunker, for they well knew the danger of these 2 boilers exploding. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Some of us old-timers might recognize that old Spike Jones song. It has something to do with the Navy. I don't know what, but had to put that in there because we're talking about the South Pole. We're talking about Antarctica, and we're talking to Bill George and Dale Cockrell, both Seabees down there. I was supposed to make an announcement. Matt, are you in there? Somebody told me to make an announcement right now. Did they? No? Okay. Maybe that was last time. ADD, folks. That's me on the hoof. What were we talking about? Bill, you were finish up that story about the New Zealanders with the sled dogs. They keep them warm if they're caught out there on the ice. Anything
well,
else?
That's what they told us. You know, they said that, the dogs could provide a number of issues if they really got pinned down. Sometimes these storms would roll in within an hour or less. You know, you'd be pinned down, you'd get in what we called a whiteout situation, where if you literally held your hand in front of your face, you couldn't see it. So when you got into those positions, the best thing to do would be to hunker down and hold off until, you know, the wind blew itself out for whatever time it took. So if they were out there on the ice somewhere and they got pinned down, they always had their dogs with them, and they could provide a number of issues to keep them alive, one of them being heat.
Yeah, well, on second thought, let's not go into the other issues. So,
I figured I'd hold off on that one.
Yeah, good deal. You know what, though? I was doing a lot of research last night about Operation Deep Freeze, and I remember the Little America was the first camp that was built there down in the 1930s, and then there was Little America, you know, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and such that were built after the war. When I got to Vietnam, we set up tents in a dried-up rice paddy and started building the camp for the rest of the battalion that was going to be coming in 30 days. I hadn't thought about this, but, you know, those camps that you guys lived in were built out on the ice, and they just didn't magically appear. There was a whole bunch of Seabees that got there and set up tents on the ice and started building the first permanent camp. Could you guys imagine doing that? Now, that was back in the 1950s, and I guess back in the 1930s, setting up and building permanent buildings on top of ice. What do you think they encountered, Bill, when they were doing that? What would the conditions have been like? Tell us about the weather, the hottest, the coldest, the winds.
I'll tell you, this was something. You know, the air base, Williams Field, we would shut it down in March. And then
and the end of August, right around September 1st, we would have to go out there and reopen. And so this place had been shut down for several months, and you get out there, and the snowpack had buried. We lived in Quonset huts that we had assembled, and they were basically floors, the arches, and then we would cover the arches with a thick insulated blanket. And, you know, you'd get out there, and the first thing everybody did was we all worked in the buddy system in pairs, because we'd be working in temperatures usually at least around 25 to 30 below out there. So
this
maximum
the
temperature.
You're saying this was the beginning of summer?
Right.
25
yeah.
to 30 below. Okay, quit, all you other people out there, quit complaining about the cold. Go ahead.
So anyways, you know, we just worked in the buddy system. I was going to say our maximum temperature at McMurdo the year that we were there, I think we were somewhere in the mid-50s below zero in the wintertime. And the summertime, the warmest temperature we got was in the mid-50s, but on the other end of the scale, above zero. So we were minus zero in the winter and plus zero in the summer. And I'll tell you, when it got to 50 degrees and you're on a glacier, it creates about 10 or 12 inches of slush on top of the glacier, and so to walk anywhere, you can't imagine how hard it's like slogging through mud.
Wow.
You know, it's hard to go anywhere. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah. What about the sun? I mean, that there couldn't have been clouds down there if there was no precipitation. Is that correct?
There would be clouds, but...
Okay.
They were usually not the precipitating, producing type of clouds, but there would be clouds.
Chance of sunburn?
Oh, sunburn was a very prevalent thing.
You know, I have to tell you, my family accused me of not being in Antarctica because I had such a nice tan. And they just took photos of my face, you know. From being out working outdoors all the time, we had a real nice tan on the face. But, the sun down there is so piercing. I think I was talking to you yesterday about the fact that when we had our roads set up, one of the issues we had with roads was keeping anything that was dark off the road surface, because the sun was so intense there that anything dark would heat up and melt down through the surface of our roads. Our road surfaces were basically frozen ice. So if you happen to get a piece of mud or stone, the sun would bake this thing, and it would melt down through that surface, and then it would create a pothole in the road, which was, we were out there maintaining these roads all the time for a service vehicle.
There were gravel lines. What were you telling me about the wind build, when the wind would blow? Go ahead.
Yeah, I said that, things you don't think about is that in the wintertime when we were there, we had winds in excess of 100 miles an hour. And if you were out watching some of this stuff, one of the things that strike you as odd is watching gravel blow down the road. You know, when we were at McMurdo on this volcanic island, you'd see stones rolling by, you know, and that's when you know the wind is really howling. I mean, you know, you just never see that.
There was also, I was looking at the temperatures, historical temperatures, and the coldest ever reported was 86 below zero Fahrenheit, and the coupled with a 100-mile-an-hour wind, what do you suppose the wind chill factor would be, Dale?
Probably around 180 to 200 below.
That's cold.
You can basically drop it a degree per mile of hour.
Oh, really? Okay.
So the close proximity of it, yeah.
Bill, what were you saying about a cup of water if you threw it up in the air?
Yeah, I said, anything where you got into temperatures that were below, that were colder than minus 20 or 22, you could literally go outside and throw a cup of water in the air, and before the water would hit the ground, it'd be ice crystal. So, I mean, you know, when you're there and you're new and you're early, you're almost like a tourist. You want to see all this stuff
right.
Once. But, you know, how many times can you throw a cup of water in the air?
You know, you do it once, you see it, you know, and you say, okay, with that one, you know,
right,
and you realize,
and
you know, and it's, you know, when it's 20 below, you know, 20 or 25 below, it's, you know, you don't stay out there very long. And by the same token, you know what, during the winter, there were times when the temperatures would warm up to, like we'd get up to like maybe 10 above. And usually that meant that a storm was coming. If we got into the warmer temperatures, that meant something was brewing, you know. But at 10 above, we would be outside in what we called a waffle iron. That would be just our thermal tops, our long sleeve underwear. And we'd be outside playing football without jackets at 10 above. So, you know, we were acclimated to it, you know, and 10 above to us felt quite warm, you know.
The wildlife. Did you see any wildlife while you were down there? Dale, you answer that one, okay?
Well, we had a population of emperor penguins, Adelie penguins, leopard seals, waddell seals, and skua gulls. They were all pretty much an everyday occurrence to see those, particularly during the summer season. You didn't see the penguins that much in after dark.
It'd be kind of hard to see them, aren't they black?
Yeah, I mean, you could,
if they were facing you, they'd just look like more ice, right?
I've got a photograph someplace, if I can find it in my archives, of an ice floe going out, and there was probably 15 or 20 Adelie penguins, and it looked like a little chorus going out to sea, but that was after the ice break. Yeah.
Now, the leopard seals, they're the big nasty
they're
ones.
The big ones. They're the ones that love to prey on penguins. And
you wouldn't want to get too close to them, I imagine.
No, no. Yeah. The waddell seals, they were just massive, very slow moving.
Gary, one of the things you had to be careful about the leopard seals is if you were anywhere that you were on what would be considered a little bit thin ice. Because a lot of times leopard seals hunted by shadows. If they saw shadows moving, you know, through the ice, these leopard seals would come shooting through the ice like a missile, thinking it's a penguin.
Right.
So, you know, we were always cautioned about thin ice is bad enough to be on, but also that it was another factor with the seals. You didn't want to be somewhere when these leopard seals would mistake you for a penguin, you know.
Do you ever see any... a minute and 10 seconds left in this, but so real quick. You ever see any killer whales down there, either
no.
of you?
No, I never saw one.
I was in the service with a guy that was going down to Antarctica. He was a CB, and their ship developed a crack in the keel during the night. It was pretty rough weather, and they thought that was pretty bad, as you could well imagine. And when the light came, they found out it was a lot worse than they imagined, because the scientists said they couldn't explain it, but it was like a migration of killer whales, and as far as you could see in either direction were killer whales that were swimming in the same direction as the ship. And so it was you know, it's going to be bad enough if the ship went down in that kind of weather, but when you're surrounded by thousands of killer whales, it sort of takes the confidence away from you, you know. It's like they say about
the bilge pumps are working.
No atheist in a foxhole. I imagine there was no atheist in the ship that day. We're coming up on a break. We're talking to two former Seabees that spent the year on the ice of Antarctica at Operation Deep Freeze, Bill George and Dale Cockrell, back in 1969. We'll be back right after these messages.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
It's been a long, long time. I think that was Glenn Miller. I'm not real sure. But for you guys down on the ice, when you were down there with nothing but a bunch of guys, it had to seem like a long, long time since you'd seen the last female. And indeed it was. What was I going to say? Oh, I put on the flyer that a little bit of a teaser about swimming on the glacier in Antarctica. That was your story. Tell us about how it was that you guys went swimming on the glacier.
Well, we had a device down there that we made our water with, and the water, what we did was we had vehicles with scoops on the front of them that would scoop snow, and we had it was like a fairly large stainless steel box called the snow melter, and we would melt the snow for our water. So this is how we supplied our galley and our drinking water from the snow mine. And what we did was at the end of the year, after the base, all the BXC-6, we called them Airedales, had left, and we were closing down Williams Field for the winter, we were a small skeleton crew there. So we filled the snow melter up and fired this baby up, and when we got the water up warm enough and the snow melter, there was a couple of us all went swimming in the snow melt. this box was probably about, I would guess, about 5 foot by 5 foot and maybe about 5 foot deep, you know. So that was our swimming pool.
Well, sort of like a hot tub, and I imagine the guys that were drinking that water in the spring didn't know what you guys had done.
No, Gary, we drained it. We were in the process. We were draining this.
Sure. I'm sure you did. But
we wouldn't do that to those Airedales. You know that.
By the way, for the non-Navy people, Airedales are the Navy guys that work on airplanes. The deck people were black shoes, and the those that worked down below decks were snipes. Snipes had red stripes. Airedales had green stripes. Black shoes had white stripes, and Seavies had blue stripes until you hit petty officer, right? Do I remember that correctly?
That's right. Yeah. We had nicknames for everybody at our GCA tower. We called them Tower Flowers, and the guys in public works that worked at the airstrip, we were strip rats. And we had nicknames. Guys that lived in McMurdo, we called that town, so we called them Town Clowns. So, you know, nicknames for everybody. That was the service.
That's the military, right.
And then each individual usually had a nickname that they go by.
Well, we had that in our squad. And, you know, the politically correct people that would gasp at some of the names we had for each other in our squad was just typical of any GIs back in those days, you know.
That's right.
We had, I won't go on the air, but, I mean, they were politically incorrect. That was the good old days.
Dale has always been well known. His nickname on the ice, he was Beef. Dale is a big guy, and he's probably, I would say, he's a big six footer, and he was always Beef. That's what we called him, you know. And
like,
and a lot of guys
Beef?
Probably didn't know his last name was Cockrell. You know?
And there's a lot of the guys we wintered with. If I call them, I have to tell them this is Beef. They don't know me by Dale. You know, it's
okay. We had a guy in our squad called Fat Willie. Well, Fat Willie had about an inch of skin that you could grab around his side, you know, and that was fat. What about shaving? How hard was it to shave down there in that cold?
Bill? I haven't shaved since I got left there.
Dale, did you shave it all down there? Every photograph I've seen of people down in the ice, they all have beards.
Pretty much, you know. There might have been a few that shaved, but pretty much everybody grew beards, you know. That was just, it was a common thing for being in Antarctica. Like I say, maybe, you know, a small percentage didn't, but you know, pretty much. You know, one of the things I was going to tell you about, I was going to mention to you, I think they tried to keep our spirits up with different things going on during the year. We had 4 months of total darkness there where we never saw the sun. So we would have celebrations, like we had a celebration for the sundown party, and we had a celebration for the midwinter party, and we had a celebration for the sun-up party. You know, that was the year that the Beatles came out with their Abbey Road album, and one of the cuts on it was Here Comes the Sun, and that was our anthem down there. You know, we were waiting for that sun. That was one of the items we really looked forward to, was if you haven't seen the sun in 4 months, you know, you want to see what that ball of fire looks like.
Oh, my. You know what? We were trying to figure out what kind of bump music. You know, that's where you come back on. Like that? Are you guys doing that accent? Did you guys do that on purpose, or did the computer do it? Thank you, computer. Right on time. The bump music, and I couldn't come up with anything, you know. And I did think of, oh, the weather outside is frightful, and then the next sentence would have been, you know, since they've had women in the military and don't ask, don't tell's gone, you know, the next sentence could have fit in there, but I thought, well, that's not politically incorrect, so I won't even talk about it. Here Comes the Sun would have been a great one to have.
Yeah, it nailed exactly what we were in, you know, and that whole song was about us, you know, that was it. It described it to a T.
And the anthem for Vietnam vets is, we got to get out of this place. You hear that at all the reunions, too. All right, I'm going to turn this just kind of like Free Fire. Bill, tell us something that I didn't ask that you think should have been covered, should have been talked
about.
Well,
you know, you got to think about our communication at that time. The only communication that we had with the states was by ham radio. So every time when we spoke to home, we ran what they call phone patches. You know, you could talk one at a time, either the person in Antarctica talk or the person at home talk. So, and in between, when you finished your talking, you would say over. And so my mother, God rest her soul, she was like an Edith Bunker. That's the best way to describe her. I loved her dearly. But she, you know, hard to listen to directions. So every time I called home, I would tell the ham operator, this is a first-time call. And they would explain to my mother, Mrs. George, I'm going to have your son. He's going to come on the line there, and he's going to talk to you. And then he's going to say over, and the phone's going to go blank. And they said, now you talk to him. He'll be able to hear you. You talk for a while, and when you're done talking, you say over again, and then he'll talk. And so then, you know, they'd put me on, and I'd say, hi, Mom, how you doing? I'm doing great. You know, the temperature's been this and that. I did this and that. And then I'd go over. And then my mother would go, Bill? Bill, are you there? and inevitably, you know, the ham operator would break in. Mrs. George, he's there. He can hear you. Just talk. You know, every time it was the same thing, you know. So, you know, people who aren't used to phone patches, you know what I mean?
Yes, so, they had them in Vietnam, but, you know, most of us didn't bother with them because it would patch all, you know, all over the world before it got home. And the same thing that you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dale, how about you? What little thing sticks out in your mind that nobody would ever think about, you know, that happened down there? Anything?
I remember the 4th of July celebration where the Kiwis tried to avenge the Queen, and they were going to steal our flag, and we stole, or somebody stole the Queen's picture. And the glass on it, as Bill reminded me, got broken and caused almost an international incident. But it was all in good fun, other than the broken glass. But
real quick, did you guys have to have psychological testing before you went down there? I heard that was for people that were going to win her over.
Yes.
And did you pass?
Evidently.
Gary, we had one individual that stood out in my mind. We went to Washington, D.C. for our screening. And so they'd have us all standing in a hallway waiting to speak to these psychologists, you know. And so they called a gentleman's name, and he came up there, and he was holding a portable TV. And he asked them, he said, can I bring my TV in with me? And they said to him, do you always carry this TV? And the guy said, well, yeah, I usually have it with me, you know. So he went in the room, and that was the last we saw. He never made it to Antarctica. So I figure they figured he was a little too attached to the TV there, you know.
You have to wonder if some of these people did it on purpose. Dale Cockrell, Bill George, former Seabees who spent the winter spent a year on the ice in Antarctica, thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time as usual, and for you guys to welcome home. Folks, tune in next week. We're going to have another fascinating program. Hopefully we'll have as much fun as today, a lot of laughs with two former Seabees. And until then, you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on this program reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.